Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In 1995, Jamie Ross was sent to prison, convicted of second-degree murder. She was 16 years old. She was sentenced to 50 years, but was released after 8 and a half. That time spent in prison was powerful for her. It turned her life around. She's been out of prison for 15 years. She's built a life, a career. She's married. She's raising 2 sons. She's moved on, but she's chosen not to leave her past behind. She's working hard to help others and to continue to keep the memory of the man who was murdered alive. She volunteers with prisoners. She speaks to young offenders, and she tells her story to anyone who's willing to listen and learn. And she's here to talk with us today. Jamie, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we're going to go back in time to 1995, a night that I know that you have relived over and over again. The crime that you were put in prison for when you were 16 years old was for helping to lure a 23-year-old man named Yuval Kadim to an isolated area where he was robbed and murdered. And that wasn't supposed to be what happened. He wasn't supposed to be killed. How did you find out that that is what happened?
I was the first one to find out, actually. And a friend had come over to my house and picked me up. And one of the first things that he said was, "Did you hear about what happened out at the Lost Planet last night?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, somebody was murdered out there." And I was hoping, against everything, that it wasn't Yuval. And so I said, "Well, was he stabbed? Was he shot? What was?" And he said, "No, he was actually beaten to death." And in that moment, life slowed down. And I knew right then and there that I needed to go forward. I needed to find courage to be able to go forward. I had this guy take me downtown where I knew that my other co-defendants would be. And as soon as I saw them, I jumped out of a moving vehicle and went running across 4 lanes of traffic, screaming, "You killed him, you effing killed him." And I was screaming pretty loudly. And one of the main guys involved came over and slapped me across my face and said, "The next one to talk is the next one to go." And at that moment, I looked him dead in his eye and I said, I'm the last B you will ever slap. And I meant it. I did go and get high that night. My mind was racing. I did drugs to kind of avoid a lot of things in my life and to not really deal with what was going on in my life, the majority of my life, or the majority of my childhood, I should say. And that night was no exception. And after I started coming down a little bit, I reached out to one of my friends who her dad is a Des Moines police officer, and I went over to her house and started talking about it.
You went forward at that point, but I mean, you had been threatened. Did you feel like your life was at risk if you told someone what happened?
At that point, right then, no. Because I was mad, and I am the kind of person that doesn't believe that somebody's soul can be fully at rest until there's accountability. And so I knew we all needed to take accountability. We all needed to come forward. So right then, I did not feel scared. I really did not feel scared until I was already in jail for this, and the media actually printed my parents' home address and did little videos in front of my house so people knew what my home looked like. I was safe in jail, but my family was not safe in their own home. That's when I started to get scared, but more so for my family. At that point, I already knew I'm already a snitch because I came forward, so that's what the public would call me. But I knew that if I testified, it would be that much worse. And so when they offered me the deal to testify, I did not take it. I was too scared to. And so, I mean, they did offer 25 years for first-degree robbery with a 10-year for involuntary manslaughter ran concurrently. But I was too scared.
You were sentenced to 50 years in prison. You were 16 years old at the time. And I want to go back further in time. You talked about getting high to escape all of the things that were difficult in your life. You'd had an extremely difficult childhood. You were sexually abused as a child. Tell me just a little bit more about what was going on in your life as you were trying to become an adult.
Well, from the age of 5 to 9, I was sexually abused by my father. And at the age of 9, when I told my mother, you know, my 9-year-old juvenile brain kind of felt more comfortable, like somebody else knows my monster, and now I'm not going to have to deal with it because parents are supposed to be there to protect you. And I really thought that when I went to bed that night that I'd wake up the next morning and I wouldn't have to deal with him again. And although the abuse did stop, he was still a very sick man and he was still in our house. And so when I woke up and I heard his voice, and it wasn't the voice of a man that was in trouble, I was really upset. I was as mad at my mom as I was my dad. And from that point forward, really, my parents could not tell me anything. I mean, to me, they weren't protecting me anymore. And in my 9-year-old brain, I can't rationalize all the adult responsibilities, the financial aspect of, you know, her having to do things on her own. And so I immediately thought that my mom loved him more than me. And at that point, when you lose all respect, they have no authority over you. And they didn't. I started smoking weed mainly because I walked in on my siblings getting high. And the best way to get somebody to not be able to tell on you is to get them involved in it. And I mean, that's the way that most younger siblings end up using. And started drinking, started hanging out with all the older kids because I didn't feel like I had a connection with anybody my age. I really felt like I was supposed to be living life faster since I knew a lot more about life than most kids my age. And it went downhill from there. My parents had no control over me. I was smoking cigarettes, drinking, getting high. It was a mess. And rather than dealing with life, and a lot of people will tell you that once they come out of drug use and things like that, you know, they're trying to numb that emotional pain. And for me, fighting was also something that I would do to mask that internal pain. So external pain is a lot easier to deal with than internal pain for kids. And so that's why you'll see a lot of cutters today. Back then, I was a fighter. And if I was feeling terrible about myself, I fought. And I fought a lot. I did poorly in school, not because I was stupid by any means. I felt like I was. But when people would say one mean thing about me, you could say 1,000 nice things about me. But you say that one mean comment, and that is what cycles in my mind until I believe it. And, you know, so I was called stupid, I was called fat, I was called ugly, and even though I was none of those things, I believed it hook, line, and sinker. And so if a teacher called on me in school and I didn't know the answer, I felt stupid right away. And I would act out, and I'd get kicked out of school pretty quickly. Didn't realize that I wasn't stupid until I actually went to prison and I had to get my GED. And I scored so high on the test that they actually made me a GED tutor for DMAC.
You have said that when you spoke to the prosecuting attorney at your trial and he looked at you and he said, "I believe you," you've said that that was the first time in your life that you really felt like an adult saw you and heard you.
Yeah. after, because I was originally charged with first-degree murder and first-degree robbery. In the state of Iowa, you do not have to physically touch your victim to be arrested for murder. There's a four-felony murder law, so if you're in the process of one felony and another one occurs, you're guilty of both as if they were both premeditated. So even though I never touched my victim, I did know about the robbery, and so I was guilty of both in the state's eyes. And when I didn't choose to testify and take that deal, I was going to be the last one to be tried. And my co-defendant right before me got off of all charges. It was acquitted and walked out of the courthouse that day. And I felt lower than I had ever felt. Because again, I didn't feel like my victim could be at rest until we were all paying for it. And here this guy was walking. And I took that as 100% my fault, because if I would have testified, there's no way he would have walked. And it was after that. My trial was supposed to start the next month, and the prosecuting attorney, Stephen Fortano, said, "I believe in you. I believe that your remorse is real, and I believe that you have the ability to change and that you've already started doing that." And that was the first adult to ever say that. And this man knew everything about me, and he was able to see past that and see that I had already started to change and already started to not only accept responsibility for my life, but take accountability for my decisions. Because for a lot of years, I blamed my sexual abuse on almost everything. If I got picked up by the police for anything, it was, you know, "Oh, don't take me home. My dad's abused me. I don't want to go." And tried to use that to get out of trouble many times. And everything that I did, well, was because I was sexually abused. And that year in jail, my lawyers actually wanted to use that as a defense. And I just told them, if that's my only defense, I don't have one, because that's not why this happened.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to Jamie Ross, and she's sharing the story of when she went to prison when she was 16 years old, convicted of second-degree murder, and how her time in prison changed her life. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest is Jamie Ross. Back in 1995, when she was 16 years old, she was sent to prison, convicted of second-degree murder. She was sentenced to 50 years, but was released in 8 and a half, and now she's been out of prison for 15 years. She has turned her life around. She has built herself a life, a career, a strong family, and she works hard now to tell her story, to help others, and to continue to keep the memory of the man who was murdered alive. And Jamie, let's talk about when you went to prison, because when you were sentenced to 50 years in prison, there was every expectation that you were going to be there for 50 years. And the way that things were done in Iowa prisons changed after you went in, and that change gave you a real opportunity. Can you tell me what happened?
Well, 9 months after our crime happened is when the state of Iowa passed the mandatory minimum sentencing law. So had I gone into prison or my crime happened 9 months later, it would have been about a 42.5-year mandatory on that 50-year sentence. When I went to prison, the average on a 50-year sentence without a mandatory in the state of Iowa is 10 to 12 years. I had zero expectations of when I was going to be released. I didn't really talk about it. I didn't ask about it. A lot of people bother their counselor every day. When am I going to be ran up to the parole board? I never did that. I lived my life in there and felt like I still feel this way to this day. No matter where you are, that's your community. If you don't like it, do something to change it. And so that's what I focused on, was, you know, doing what I could to change the prison for the better. When the mandatory minimum sentencing law passed, we didn't know how it was going to affect people without mandatories. Sometimes it can still reflect upon other people, even though they didn't get the mandatory. And everybody else that had been in, all the other people in with a 50-year sentence, had not gone anywhere. The state of Iowa really hadn't released any full-on long-termers 50 years or up for a very long time. And so really the day that they told me I was going to get to see the parole board, I thought my counselor was joking. She said, no, I'm serious. And so I had myself convinced that they were going to deny me to my face, because when kids go into prison, there's a few different roads that they can travel down. Either they feel like they've got to be tough, they get into altercations a lot, or they end up spending their time, the majority of their time, in the hole. And I didn't do any of that because I was already tired by the time I made it to prison. So I was able to use that time to change my life and change the world around me. I wish that, you know, you can pinpoint one or two things, but the reality of the situation is I was raised in prison by staff who cared even though they're not paid to care, and other inmates who really cared that the world out here wouldn't believe that they do. Going in at 16, a lot of the long-termers saw me as one of their kids that they can't be around.
Right.
And so I was able to have a lot of good support from the very first day.
You often speak about a moment when you were in a group talking about what victims go through, trying to understand what the ramifications of your crime, of the crimes of all of the people in the group, were. Tell me about that moment that you really had a realization.
So that's a victim impact class, and the Department of Corrections actually did away with that a couple years back, and I really feel like not only should every inmate have to go through that class, but I believe that every middle school and high school student should have to go through that class. This world lacks so much empathy, and that class really helps you to hone in on that. I was 5 years into my sentence when I finally was able to take that class. Prior to that, long-termers were not able to take any kind of classes because we were considered more or less a waste of time because we weren't going anywhere. Rehabilitation wasn't for us, it was for the short-termer. And so when I finally got to take it, I thought that I had pretty much processed a lot of the stuff since I was 5 years in. But we're halfway through. In this class, is a 12-week course. It starts with crimes that people deem petty crime or not a crime against a person, so stealing from a store. And it takes you through all the levels that a victim has to go through to kind of restore some sort of normalcy, even to the fact that, you know, the cost gets passed down to the next consumer because they have to pay extra for security and stocking and, you know, every little thing that they have to go through and all the insurance on all their property. And then halfway through, we're at child maltreatment and child abuse. And that day, I just sat there looking around thinking, I know every single woman in this room has been sexually abused, raped, beaten, robbed. You know, there's so many different things that we go through as humans, even just verbally, emotionally, and physically. So I said, you know, because I speak up, surprise, surprise, I said, you know, we all know what it feels like to be a victim. And that counselor was smart enough to turn around. And she said to me, she said, you know, if you know what it feels like to be a victim, why would you want anybody else to feel that way? And that right there made me shut my mouth and open my ears for the first time in my entire time.
You talked about how there were people in prison who took you under their wing. But you developed quite the reputation for helping others in prison. Tell me about that.
I did. I'm not sure if I can say this on this
radio station.
I think
you can say it. Go ahead.
But my nickname was Captain Save-A-Ho because I was always trying to, well, at the point, kind of rescue people. So even if people were in bad relationships and they were being abused by another inmate, I would try to build them up to make sure that they understand that they don't have to be in that. They don't have to be around that. They can use this time for them, and they don't have to be in those situations. And some of the girlfriends of the people that I was working with didn't really care for that. And so they gave me that nickname that kind of stuck, and that's fine. But, you know, even down to some of the officers reminded me a couple years back that I almost threw a fit until we fenced off an area where a family of bunnies was, because people kept going around and trying to mess with the bunnies, and I did not want that mama to neglect her baby. So we put a snow fence up around it to protect the bunnies, and that's how I did even with the other inmates. If they needed something, even if it was something that, you know, somebody that I didn't talk to all the time, they knew that they could come talk to me. And I was part of the Big Sister program that we created in there, to where as soon as new inmates came into the prison or returnees came back, we would go down and we would reorientate them into prison and, you know, let them know right away what they don't need to be doing, what they can choose to do their time their own way. They don't have to be affected by everybody else. And that's what we did. And we created a whole team of people that were doing things like that. And some of the programs are still in there today. And that's an amazing thing.
Yeah,
I still get to
good.
Go back there and see it.
Yeah.
That's a miracle.
So when you got out, I mean, you talked about being raised in prison. You learned so much. You gained so many skills when you were in prison. But leaving prison has to be an incredible challenge. I mean, you're starting from scratch when you get out. How did you cope with that transition?
You know, people have a hard time understanding when I tell them that I was more scared to leave prison than I was to go to prison. I was 16 when I went to prison. I knew nothing about getting a job. I knew nothing about paying bills. I knew nothing about how to set up bills to pay bills, how to even get bills. I knew nothing. It was terrifying to think about all of that. Even paying for gas at the pump, that was a newer technology. And so when I first got out, and you just don't even know what to do. You don't even know what to do with yourself. Everything has been decided for you, you know, all through prison. You make no real decisions for yourself. And now here it was. Thank God I went to work release for 6 months. And the work release, you know, said, well, you're the first long-termer that we've really processed out, and you're the first young long-termer that we've processed out. So we don't really know what your needs are. And we just decided that day that we were both going to work together through it. And everything that I'm the kind of person that the way I process through things is just to talk about it. And so when I got scared walking down to Hy-Vee on that first day to cash my prison paycheck with my prison ID, I was able to go back and say, this is how I'm feeling about this. If I was panicked because I missed the bus, and the Department of Corrections considers that OPA, or out of place of assignment, and you can get into a lot of trouble for that. I was able to like call them and be like, I missed the bus. Like, I wasn't quick enough, and be able to process through rather than get so scared, which a lot of people do. They get so scared and then they just compound things, mm-hmm. and it becomes a bigger situation.
Cascade,
but
yeah.
Nobody wakes up here's what I always have to remind myself. Nobody wakes up one day and says, you know what? It's a beautiful day in June. I think I'll go to prison. It's one small bad decision that snowballs into so many others until it becomes unmanageable. And it's the same way when you're changing your life. You don't wake up one day thinking, oh, I got all the answers now. I'm good. I got this. It's one small good decision that snowballs into so many others. And when I started talking about things in prison openly, and you can ask just about any other inmate that I did time with or even the staff, I wasn't in prison. I was freer than I had ever been, because I was able to be open and honest about everything in my life. And I didn't have a damn thing to hide from. And that's pretty much the message that I brought with me out here.
As you built your life and you've done so well for yourself, your good decisions have snowballed and you have a really good life now. Why did you decide to tell your story? Because I can imagine a lot of people in your position wanting to leave that identity behind, but you've embraced it. Why?
Well, I've seen when people start to either deny where they came from or try to hide where they've come from, to me, that's still living your life in the dark. Once you start feeling like you need to hide things from people, that's where it's easy for sickness to come back. It's easy for criminal thinking to come back. It's easy for chemical dependency to come back. And so I try to tell people all the time, you know, when you live your life in the light, you have nothing to really hide from. And so I knew coming out that, one, my crime was a very high-profile crime since our victim was not from this country. It was on national news. It was on international news. And so I knew at any point coming out, if the media found out, it could be blasted all over. You know, you see when they're releasing long-termers, if it was a high-profile crime and they find out about it, they'll show you where they live. They'll show you everything. So I knew at any point the media could catch up with me. I knew that I have two co-defendants serving life plus 25 years. And anytime that they go through an appeal process, it gets brought up in the news. Anytime that there's a bunch of young people getting arrested for serious crimes, they bring up the whole gamut of people. And so I just knew right away I was just going to be honest with everybody. And I'm honest with my employers. I'm honest with everybody that's ever hired me. I'm honest with, to me, if God or my higher power puts it in my heart to speak about, I do. And I have nothing to hide from that. I feel that once you are more honest about things and you're upfront about it, people tend to judge you a lot less than if they find out a lot later. My past, everybody has a past. We all have a story, and we all have the capability of helping not only ourselves, but helping others along the way. And I feel like some of the things that we're giving to us to go through in this life is so that we can help other people.
So when you speak to groups of young offenders and young people who are not offenders, what do you want them to take away from your story? What do you want those kids to hear?
What I want them to understand is that even though everybody's looking at them as kids right now, they still have the capability of making good decisions. And one of the biggest things that I like to talk to them about is knowing who you're around. This group of kids that I was with, that this happened, I had just met them. I knew nothing about them. And had I vetted my friends a little bit better, or had I even paid attention or listened to my own instincts that I used to shut down, had I listened to that, things could have turned out a lot differently for me. I like them to understand that, one of the biggest regrets of almost everyone that's incarcerated is failure to follow through with education. And all of them regret that. All of them regret how they picked their friends, not listening to their parents more. You know, older people have a tendency to be able to hone in on their instincts. So when your parents are saying, you know, I really don't like you around this person, pay attention to that, because they've honed in on their instincts that you haven't quite developed quite yet. Had I listened to a lot of other adults in my life, maybe this wouldn't have happened. It was hard for me with other adults before I went to prison, because of the fact that I felt like if my own parents couldn't protect and love me, then how could anybody else say that they love me? And so I didn't trust a lot of people. I didn't trust a lot of adults, but I also didn't trust myself. And until I learned how to trust myself, respect myself, and love myself, I couldn't do that for anybody else either. And I mean, you see that still today in this world so often, that, you know, people always looking for love or always looking for something to fill a void. And if you can't find that within yourself, you will never find that in somebody else. and I was codependent before I went to prison. Now I know that I can stand on my own. I choose not to, but I do know that I can trust myself to make the right decisions in life.
Jamie, thank you so much for talking with me today.
I appreciate the opportunity, and thank you for allowing me to share my story.
Jamie Ross, she went to prison in 1995. Since her release, she has built a life, a career, she's raising two sons, and she tells her story every chance she gets to try to help others learn from her experiences. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with Larry Untiet. He's been teaching speech and drama at Spencer High School for 44 years. This is his last. Talk of Iowa, weekday mornings at 10.